Section 2, Reconstruction in South Carolina. As you read, look for how resistance by white South Carolinians to their new status led to a new constitution in 1868 and to Republican rule in the state. The triumphs and tragedies of black leaders in the Republican era. The successes of radical Reconstruction. Terms: propaganda, discrimination, amnesty. All these questions about Reconstruction that divided the American people played out in South Carolina, the state with the largest number of freedmen in its population. In 1870, blacks outnumbered whites 415,667 to 289,814. This fact alone ensured that the Reconstruction of South Carolina would be a tough and tragic process. South Carolina under Presidential Reconstruction, 1865 to 1867. When the Confederacy collapsed, President Johnson appointed Benjamin F. Perry as temporary governor until a new constitution could be written and elections held. Perry had been a Unionist journalist and member of the General Assembly before the war. He had opposed secession, but supported the secession convention's decision in 1860. The Benjamin F. Perry Administration. Benjamin F. Perry allowed the old Confederate state officials to keep their positions. He allowed the organization of volunteer all-white militia companies. Other than recommending that the state ratify the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, his brief administration appeared to be a return of the old guard. According to federal instructions, Perry called a constitutional convention. The Constitution of 1865 was slightly more democratic than the antebellum document, but those elected under it were not very different from those elected before and during the war. White Carolinians were determined that their military defeat should not mean Northerners could change the Southern way of life. A Northern journalist traveling in the South soon after the war noted, "In South Carolina, a more virulent animosity, bitter hostility, existing in the minds of the common people against the government and people of the North than in any other state I visited." The James L. Orr Administration. The first governor elected under the new Constitution and the first one in history elected directly by the state's voters, not the General Assembly, was James L. Orr. Before the war, he had served in the Congress and as Speaker of the House of Representatives. As governor from November 1865 to June 1868, Orr presided over the reopening of South Carolina College as the University of South Carolina and the opening of the new state penitentiary. He authorized the purchase of artificial arms and legs for the many Confederate soldiers who had come home mangled by war. In the fall of 1865, the General Assembly ratified the 13th Amendment, but then proceeded to pass the Black Codes. The legislature refused to ratify the 14th Amendment. Ordinary white citizens showed resistance by reorganizing armed night patrols, which had been a standard feature at many times during slavery. Patrols that had kept slaves in line and prevented runaways were now used to protect whites' property, intimidate freedmen, and enforce white supremacy. It was these attitudes and actions that caused the U.S. Congress to require new constitutional conventions in South Carolina and the other southern states. South Carolina under Congressional Radical Reconstruction. The turmoil in the state in early 1868 is almost beyond description. Blacks were excited about the new opportunity to have some control over their own destiny. In 3 years, with the help of the federal government, they had advanced from slavery to an opportunity for political equality. It had all come too fast for most whites. White's excitement was chiefly anxiety about this new challenge to their order and their superiority. The Constitution of 1868. The new Constitutional Convention was unique in South Carolina history. It was composed of 73 blacks and 51 whites. The delegates met early in 1868 and completed South Carolina's most remarkable and most democratic constitution. This biracial democracy was to provide equal voting rights and equal political opportunity for all men. For the first time since 1670, a man did not have to own property to hold office. Representation in the General Assembly was based solely on population, not the population and wealth formula that had always favored the Low Country. Greater control over local affairs was granted to new county governments. Local people could finally elect their own officials, who could tax the people to take care of local needs, such as roads, schools, and police protection. The Constitution required the first statewide public education system in South Carolina, equally available to all children. This concept of equality was what made the new Constitution seem so radical and what caused most white Carolinians to reject it. Republican rule in South Carolina. In July 1868, the first general election was held. The Republican Party swept almost every office in the state. Over 80% of the General Assembly was Republican. The majority of those were black, 75 out of 124 in the House, and 10 out of 32 in the Senate. Robert K. Scott, a white Union Army officer from Ohio, was elected governor. He had been head of the Freedmen's Bureau in South Carolina, which gave him much influence with black voters. Francis L. Cardozo was elected Secretary of State, the first black man elected to a statewide office in South Carolina. Cardozo was the son of a Charleston Jewish man and a free African-American woman. He studied in Scotland and London before returning to Charleston after the war as a minister with the American Missionary Association. He was a key member of the Constitutional Convention of 1868 and was interested in establishing a public school system. Also in July, the new General Assembly ratified the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and established circuit courts across the state. South Carolina had now met the requirements of Congress. Military supervision over the state government ended. Not all troops were moved from the state, but the army was no longer in control. The new Republican administration faced many problems, especially with determined opposition from the white minority that controlled most of the state's wealth. The white Carolinians' use of force and intimidation increased after the introduction of the black vote and the reduced presence of federal troops. Threats, beatings, and murder of Republican voters and office holders became routine in Reconstruction South Carolina. Traditional conservative whites had no intention of losing control of their civilization to a gang of freedmen, carpetbaggers, and scalawags without a fight. The 12 years of Reconstruction in South Carolina were years of struggle and anxiety that nearly equaled the Civil War in intensity. The peak of black participation. The years after 1868 were times of increasing participation by blacks in the political life of the state. The 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, ratified in 1870, guaranteed the right of African Americans to vote. By 1872, 61% of the General Assembly was black, almost exactly equal to their percentage of the total population. African Americans chaired most of the committees and elected black speakers of the House and presidents pro tem of the Senate until the end of Reconstruction. Blacks served in statewide offices of lieutenant governor, but never governor, secretary of state, secretary of treasury, and Attorney General. 6 blacks were elected to Congress. Perhaps most inconceivable for conservatives was the election of Jonathan J. Wright, a black attorney, as Justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court. The influence of blacks in politics was greater in South Carolina than in any other state for one brief moment in time. White scalawags and carpetbaggers were also important in the Republican majority. Either a northerner or a native white Republican was governor each term from 1868 to 1877. Many served with blacks in the General Assembly, and hundreds served in various county positions. Propaganda against Radical Reconstruction. The conservatives' condemnation of virtually all Republicans as corrupt, incompetent, low-class, uncouth troublemakers helped unify white opinion against the Reconstruction regime. The propaganda, accusations spread deliberately to further a cause or damage an opposing cause, was more easily believable because quite a number of Republican politicians were indeed corrupt and incompetent. Unfortunately, corruption was common all over the country in this era. One of the tragedies of the era is that most Northerners came to believe the propaganda, causing them to lose enthusiasm for the experiment in a biracial democracy. And everyone understood that Northern public opinion and the U.S. Army were necessary for South Carolina Republicans to hold out against the determined resistance of armed white citizens. Even more tragic for the long run was the fact that for many more decades, most Americans believed the propaganda that Reconstruction was imposed by congressmen seeking revenge and was carried out by ignorant and corrupt blacks, scalawags, and carpetbaggers. Those opinions were used to justify subjecting blacks to a system of segregation and discrimination, prejudiced treatment of a group, for another 100 years. Black leadership. The truth is that many of the black leaders and politicians were able, educated, and competent. The truth also is that some were incompetent and some were corrupt. A few members of the General Assembly were illiterate. This put them at a disadvantage, but it does not mean they were ignorant or stupid. Most black legislators were literate property owners from a middle class of farmers, store owners, and craftsmen. About 25% of the black legislators had been free before the war. Robert Brown Elliott was one of the most distinguished of those legislators. He served 2 terms in Congress, earning a reputation as a powerful speechmaker. In 1874, he returned to South Carolina to serve in the State House of Representatives as its speaker for 2 years. Serving in Congress with Elliott was Joseph Hayne Rainey. Born a slave in Georgetown, Rainey became the first black man ever elected to Congress from any state. He courageously voted for amnesty, pardon granted to a large group of individuals for former Confederate officials. Alonzo Jacob Ransier, a free black in Charleston prior to the war, served as the first black lieutenant governor. He advocated racially integrated education and granting the vote to women. Benjamin Franklin Randolph came from Ohio as a soldier during the war, then worked with the Freedmen's Bureau. He served in the state Senate and as chair of the state Republican Party. While campaigning in October 1868, he was murdered. Ku Klux Klansmen were suspected of committing the crime, but no one was punished. Randolph was one of 4 Republican leaders assassinated in 1868. It is difficult for citizens in the 21st century to understand what a total change for America these black officeholders were during Reconstruction. To put it in perspective, before Reconstruction, only 2 black persons had held any public offices anywhere in the United States. By the end of Reconstruction, about 2,000 black men had served in various official positions in the South. Many were minor local officials, but some were lieutenant governors, congressmen, and judges. Other important figures of the time were church leaders, newspaper editors, and political organizers. Many emerged from slavery and responded like one freedman leader who said, quote, "I walked out like a man when freedom came and shouldered my responsibilities." Successes of Radical Reconstruction. These black leaders, along with white scalawags and carpetbaggers, had some successes during Reconstruction. Perhaps most important, they provided an example of what a biracial democracy might look like. The brief period of Republican government from 1868 to 1877 served as an inspiration decades later that blacks and whites could work together as political equals. One of the most significant changes the biracial democracy made was the initiation of the state's first statewide public school system. It was certainly imperfect, with never enough money and operating only about 5 months per year. Most schools were not racially integrated. By 1875, less than half the school-aged children were in school, but it was a foundation on which to build in the future. The state also established programs for the blind and deaf. Race relations were a bit more open and socially integrated during Reconstruction compared to what went before and what came afterward. For a short period, there was integrated access to parks and recreational areas, businesses, trains, and other transportation. Northern travelers were shocked to see blacks and whites mingling in stores and ice cream shops. No doubt these opportunities were more available in larger towns, and no doubt many whites objected, but at least the possibility of better race relations was evident. Interracial marriages were strongly discouraged, but a few occurred in Charleston churches. A small professional black upper class developed during Reconstruction. For the first time, blacks could operate in South Carolina as lawyers, ministers, doctors, nurses, and teachers. African Americans in some towns and cities could serve as policemen and firemen for the first time. Labor unions were created in Charleston and perhaps elsewhere. Other accomplishments of Radical Reconstruction include a provision in the Constitution of 1868 that prohibited taking away a debtor's home to satisfy the debt. The Constitution also outlawed the custom of imprisoning people for being in debt. Blacks could serve on juries, and their testimony could be accepted in court. Women could finally own and control property, even if they were married. A woman's property could not be taken to satisfy the debts of her husband. Furthermore, divorce, which previously required an act of the General Assembly, could be granted by judges. These were significant gains for women's rights, but no serious consideration was given to allowing women to vote. Of less lasting value was the temporary racial integration of the University of South Carolina. The school had closed during the war and only opened for a short time during Reconstruction. It had only 65 students before Republicans required its integration in 1873. The next year, it had 156 students, one-half to two-thirds were black. The university hired its first black professor, Richard T. Greener, who had been the first black graduate of Harvard. In addition to teaching and being a politically active Republican, Greener attended the university's new law school and later became a lawyer. Several black lawyers received their training before the whole university was closed down at the end of Reconstruction. The school reopened in 1880 as an all-white institution. The black lawyers who received their training during that brief window of opportunity played important roles in the black communities of the state for decades. Religion and race during Reconstruction. The racial transition during Reconstruction had great effects on the churches of the state. After emancipation, freedmen tended to form their own churches to express their sense of freedom from white control. Churches became centers of social and political action within black communities. Ministers to these congregations often missionaries from the North, provided much of the political leadership of the Republican Party. Many of the new black congregations joined Northern church denominations, Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterians, rather than the denomination's Southern branches. Other congregations joined either of two national all-black churches, the African Methodist Episcopal, AME Church, or the AME Zion Church. Church membership among blacks soared during the decade after emancipation. The most rapidly growing denomination was the Baptist. The black denominations, like the white, were interested in education. The Northern Methodists were instrumental in founding Chaffin College in Orangeburg in 1869 as the first African-American college in the state. Northern Baptists founded Benedict College in Columbia in 1870. The AME Church established Payne Institute in Cokesbury in 1870. They moved it to Columbia in 1880 and renamed it Allen University. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form propaganda, discrimination, amnesty. 2. What provisions in the Constitution of 1868 made it one of the most democratic in the state's history? 3. What advantages did freedmen feel they gained by forming their own churches after emancipation? 4.